Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. As important as it is for tribes to encourage and support small business, sometimes it makes sense for tribes and individual entrepreneurs to go international. For someone new to the game, it might be hard to know why or when to take business to markets beyond your borders. But we hope to get some answers to those two questions this hour and get an idea about what to consider before you decide to expand your customers into another country. That conversation starts after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. Indian country business is getting done in Las Vegas this week as more than 4,000 people are gathered for the 2024 Reservation Economic Summit. It's put on by the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. The summit features tribal leaders, members of Congress, federal agency representatives, state and local officials, and top CEOs all gathered together on a national platform. Attendee Henry Jake Foreman is the program director for New Mexico Community Capital based in Albuquerque, which assists Native-owned businesses. He says an important goal for his nonprofit in the next year is to connect with high urban indigenous communities. The organization is building a technology hub in downtown Albuquerque, which is a co-working space and an innovation spot. He says they're also seeking to expand hubs beyond New Mexico.
We saw that we want to work in other urban settings that have high indigenous populations. So in Phoenix, Arizona, they have one of the highest urban indigenous populations. So we also want to create a hub there as well. We're looking into Oakland, California, where we've done programming in the past. We're traveling to Oklahoma City next week, as well as in Alaska as well.
Also, during the summit, U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack announced the Biden administration is investing $58 million in tribal communities in Nevada, Oklahoma, and South Dakota to provide clean drinking water, sanitary wastewater systems, and affordable high-speed internet. Vilsack says that when it comes to helping a community grow economically, access to clean water and water sanitation should be a no-brainer.
Making sure that tribes have access to clean water and wastewater treatment, that's absolutely essential to economic opportunity and development.
As for high-speed internet, Vilsack says that regardless of how small or rural a community is, access to high-speed internet is crucial and that working with the Reconnect program is going to help make that happen.
You cannot have a modern economy without access to the high-speed internet. And that's been, I think the president has been very clear about this. He wants all areas, regardless of how remote they may be, to have access to this incredibly important tool.
The Res Summit wraps up on Thursday. Bitter cold keeps bugs at bay, but climate change is giving invasive pests like emerald ash borer a leg up, which can cause serious economic damage. After Wisconsin's warmest winter on record, Lena Tran of member station WUWM reports on how tribes in the state are keeping track of the problem.
Warming winters have encouraged the spread of invasive pests like the tiny green ash borer beetle. That makes fending off pests harder. Tracking their spread is a key part of the effort. Melissa Johnson is with the Wisconsin Tribal Conservation Advisory Council. She leads a pest survey across tribal land in the state. Before it started about 5 years ago, tribal forests weren't included in the state-run surveys.
The tribes, the more knowledge they have about their land, the better. And it's not like an insect knows, you know, reservation boundaries or county boundaries.
Devin Matoxin-Hamilton is a senior at UW-Stevens Point and an Oneida citizen. He checks a trap hanging from an oak tree. Matoxin-Hamilton says he almost wants his summer job to be boring.
To be doing this, but then again, it's like if you find something, it's a good thing and a bad thing. Bad that it's here, good that you've detected it early.
None of them identify as bug people. They're doing this because of the threat that non-native bugs pose to the trees and the birds that they love. For National Native News, I'm Lena Tran in Milwaukee.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by BNSF Railway, proudly supporting the nation's economy by moving the goods that feed, supply, and power communities across the country. More at bnsf.com/tribalrelations.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Live from the Reservation Economic Summit in Las Vegas, Nevada, you are listening to Native America Calling, and I'm your host, Sean Spruce. The reach of tribal business is unlimited. At least that's the perspective you'll hear from guests on our show today. They all have their eyes on international business opportunities for tribes and Native entrepreneurs. Tribes have advantages when it comes to global trade. The unique status as sovereign entities and their ability to avoid state and federal taxes are in the plus column. But there are limitations, too. The first is something any business looking to expand into foreign markets faces: how to connect their product or service with an overseas base with a foreign culture, different language, and a new set of laws and regulations. Yesterday, we looked at Native small business, and today we'll get a view into big and small businesses that see potential on an international scale. If you want to join our conversation today, give us a call. We've got the studio lines open, 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And with that, let's go ahead and meet our guest today. Joining us here at the trade show in the Caesars Palace at the Reservation Economic Summit, we have, first up, Mr. Chris James. And he is the president and CEO of the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. He is a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. Chris, brother, it's great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Hey, thanks, Sean. Great to be here.
Also joining me here at the table at our booth number 423 in the trade show is Diana Mitrovic. She is a U.S. Department of Commerce International Trade Specialist and the CEO and founder of DM Global Consulting. Diana, good morning and welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning, Sean. Good morning, Native America Calling. It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
It's a pleasure to have you. We also have three guests who are joining us by telephone today. First, we have Chairman Leonard Forsman. He's in Washington State. He's the chairman of the Suquamish Tribe. Good morning, Chairman Forsman. How are you?
Hawkshill Hill, doing well up here.
Wonderful. Also joining us over the phone is Wayne Garnins-Williams. He's up in Ottawa, Canada right now. He is the chair of the International Intertribal Trade and Investment Organization, and he is Plains Cree from Treaty 6, Musumin First Nation. Hello, Wayne, and welcome to our show.
Hello, Tante.
And one more guest on the telephone, Shawnee, Oklahoma, Dr. Jim Collard. He is the Citizen Potawatomi Nation Director of Planning and Economic Development. Hello, Jim, and thank you for joining us as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
I am too. With that, let's go ahead and get things started. Chris, this is just such an amazing event. I've heard numbers as high as 4,500 registered people here attending, businesses, tribes, nonprofits, individual entrepreneurs. Just how pleased are you so far with the summit, and what are some trends you're seeing right now just on the floor and with people you're talking to?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. This year's Reservation Economic Summit is the actual largest we've ever had, with, like you said, over 4,500 attendees here at the summit. I mean, it's pretty amazing. We're sitting here in the trade show floor now and just seeing all the excitement of all these businesses that are surrounding us. And really, their goal is to do economic development. Their goal is to expand their markets. Their goal is to grow their businesses. As of trends, man, there's so many things going on. We have had sessions today and yesterday, all from trade, all the way to federal contracting, all the way to international treaties. We've had five secretaries speak from the U.S. government. So it's really just an amazing conference. We really appreciate your support.
Well, I'm just so impressed. And we had representation from just all over the United States, a lot of folks from Canada as well. And Chris, a really interesting highlight right now in your career is you were on President Biden's Advisory Council on Trade. Tell us about that role and what more needs to be done with regard to tribes engaging in trade and especially international opportunities.
Yeah, Sean, that's a great question. I mean, absolutely, our communities need to be involved in not only trade, but also in the discussion of talking about treaties. And many of your guests and I have had lots of conversations about United States' role in various treaties and how we work around trade and some of the advantages of trade. So I think being part of this advisory committee, working with the United States Trade Representative on this scale, and being really able to always have that seat at the table to talk about our indigenous populations and how we are able to cross sometimes our reservation into doing into other parts of the United States, but now crossing international borders. And I think that is so important that our businesses are looking at doing goods outside of reservations, doing goods outside of the international borders, and creating partnerships internationally.
Well, let's talk about some specific tribes, specific Native businesses, and what are some examples of tribes that you see in entrepreneurs just doing really, really interesting projects overseas?
Well, we have a whole gambit of communities looking at various opportunities. One particular individual business is the Kana Group that's here at Res. They are working in Australia. They're doing some amazing work with some Fortune 500 companies. As of tribes looking at moving their goods, we have a lot of tribes that are looking at agriculture that are saying, how can we get our products across sea, especially in the soy area. We have other types of goods, including fisheries and all sorts of stuff, moving across borders and into international markets.
And Chris, what do you say to a tribe or an entrepreneur who comes up to you and says, geez, this international trade stuff, it sounds exciting, it sounds cool, but it also sounds risky. Why go abroad? There's so many opportunities stateside. Why not focus our efforts locally or regionally as opposed to internationally? What's your response to an entrepreneur with that perspective?
I think we should always look at all the open doors for us. If there's any availability to sell our goods across borders, I think that's so important. It really can expand the business's reach, and it can create new partnerships on not only the grassroots level, but also expanding that grassroots level to an international level.
And what do you think tribes and Native entrepreneurs, what do you think they offer international markets that other corporations and other businesses just don't do?
We have such a diverse range of tribal businesses. We have such a diverse range of individual businesses. So our businesses are doing amazing things. Regardless of the products that they're offering, they have that ability to diversify their business and to reach into other indigenous communities as well, and having that indigenous to indigenous connection.
It's just fascinating. Again, I just continue to be overwhelmed by the turnout, just the enthusiasm. Just looking around here in this trade show, and it's just such a huge event. Last night you had a big fashion show, just so many different receptions and just a lot of partnerships. And I just want to congratulate you, Chris, on your success. We've known each other for a long time, and I've just been a big fan of yours and seen your career arc. And it's just, you see arcs like this and you see arcs like this, and this is yours. You're just on this like straight line path to the moon. So congratulations, brother. Anything else you want to share? I know your time is limited, and I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning.
No, I really appreciate it, Sean, and I really, your other guests on the phone, we have had multiple conversations on this, and we look forward to those partnerships and those connections, and how can we work together to help our business not only here in the United States grow, but also in Canada and beyond, and in crossing those international borders is very important to us. And we're there to help, not only here at Res, but after Res is done.
And Res is not done yet. We still got a couple of days, and I'm going to enjoy myself. So I will see you later in a continued success here for the next couple of days.
Thanks, Sean.
All righty. Thank you. Well, Deanna, This is just such an interesting event here. And let's talk about your role as a trade specialist. I want to learn more about what you do and what's your connection here is at Res, and what opportunities do you see here on the floor?
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. So we are part of the International Trade Administration, which is U.S. federal government, and we are your government resource to help your companies compete in global markets. So our agency is led by the Undersecretary, Marisa Lagov, Undersecretary for International Trade. She's here with us today at Res 2024. And U.S. Commercial Service, which is part of the International Trade Administration, creates jobs in the United States and strengthens our U.S. economic and national security by promoting U.S. exports of goods and services. And Kristen, you just mentioned the fashion show. So why not next time organize a fashion show overseas during one of our trade missions? So that's also a good opportunity for the native businesses. And just this morning while I was driving, I live here in Las Vegas, driving to the Caesars Palace, at the traffic light, there was a car in front of me saying Native American-owned business. And I was very, very happy. It was a sign that it was a day for your celebration and for Res 2024. So what's our role is also like that we ensure that market access for the American companies and we a level playing field in international trade. We are strategically located in 106 U.S. and 127 foreign offices in the U.S. embassies and consulates abroad in 80 countries. And our global network of trade and investment professionals are well positioned to help U.S. companies succeed internationally. And we are the first line of defense against unfair foreign trade practices and market access barriers. So we do work a lot with native businesses. One of the companies that our office in Tulsa, Oklahoma works with has been recognized today by our Undersecretary, Marisa Lago, with the U.S. Department of Commerce Export Achievement Certificate. And another office of ours in Phoenix, Arizona, collaborates with the Navajo Nation and speaks during their economic summit. And overall, our International Trade Administration has a strategic partnership with the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development. Partner on webinars, seminars, today at the Building Bridges panel session, and we want to highlight that we are a trade finance resource for
your companies. Wonderful. Deanna, we're going to have to take a short break. We come back, we're going to learn more about the work you do, and we're going to talk to our guests on the phone as well. So listeners, if you want to give us a call, we got the phone lines open, 1-800-99-NATIVE.
This year's Native 40 Under 40 Awards include several tribal leaders, two notable actors, and someone who produces organic indigenous food for children. This year's class is being recognized this week at the Reservation Economic Summit in Las Vegas. We'll talk to some of them on the next Native America Calling.
Are you a Native American healthcare provider, recovery counselor, social worker, domestic and sexual abuse advocate, or traditional healer working in Native American communities? Dr. Ruby Gibson will begin an advanced immersion in healing historical trauma. This online masterclass in somatic archaeology uses the lens of a seven-generational recovery approach, providing powerful modalities, and is offered tuition-free to tribal members. Registration deadline is March 1st. Info at freedomlodge.org. Who support this show?
Thanks for tuning in today to Native America Calling, live from the Reservation Economic Summit, Caesars Palace, Las Vegas, Nevada, trade show floor. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. What do you think when I mention Native-owned business? That's the question. Well, today, we're looking at some expanded horizons for international markets. That's our focus today. And if you have a question about what it takes to connect as a business owner with foreign customers, give us a call. We've got people on the show today who can answer your questions. 1-800-996-2848. And let's go to our guests who are joining us on the phone now. First up, Chairman Leonard Forsman with the Suquamish Tribe in Washington State. And Chairman, I want to thank you again today for joining us. And let's talk a little bit about the Suquamish Tribe's international efforts in business, the Suquamish Seafood Enterprises specifically. Tell us about what types of goods you folks are exporting.
We're up here near Seattle, or the home of Chief Seattle, Suquamish Tribe, and we have a chartered enterprise that exercises our treaty right to harvest shellfish here in the Puget Sound Salish Sea, and we harvest a giant gooey duck clam that lives underwater, only exposed usually on really high tides, but on we can go intertidal with our dive team of tribal citizens, and they harvest the clam. We package it in our plant, and then same day bring it to the airport at SeaTac and ship it overseas to China, where it's a very treasured delicacy and can fetch a pretty good price. We are subject oftentimes to U.S. trade relationships can interrupt our deliveries sometimes, and that can depends on the U.S. trade relationships. But it does provide our people with a great income, and they can get out on the water and harvest these things in a traditional way of life. So it's very very key to our economy and our government funding. We have had some challenges in the past because of harvest rates have gone down for conservation purposes, but we're working through that and look forward to growing that industry through other enhancement of intertidal beds.
Okay. Now, Chairman, for our listeners today who are maybe not from the Pacific Northwest, explain to us what exactly is a gooey duck and what goes into to the harvesting? I know you have local divers that harvest it, but tell us more.
Okay, well, it's a giant clam that lives in very, very deep water, relatively deep water, I should say. It ranges from about 20 to 80 feet in depth. And the harvesters go under with surface supplied air. So they're hooked up to a compressor on our vessel, and they go over with a water gun, look for the clams. Sometimes they're hard to find. And sometimes, like I say, anywhere from 30 to 75 feet underwater. They use this water gun to free the clam and put it in a bag, and they'll get the harvest quota for that day. The clams are brought up to the surface. They're banded to keep them alive because the Chinese like a live product. And then, like I said, they're packaged, iced, and brought to the airport usually that same day and overnighted to China, where they're important cultural delicacy for them that they use in the restaurant trade, in the restaurant market. So I've been over there to Shanghai before and seen them, and they bring them in live. They put them in an aquarium tank, and the people pick out their gooey duck that they want to eat. It's got a very long neck. It's very meaty, and it's kind of a sweet-tasting clam.
Okay, and a delicacy, I imagine.
It is a delicacy in China, yes.
Okay. Well, Chairman, tell us a little bit more. What have you folks learned about doing business overseas? What types of challenges have you encountered, and what solutions were you able to develop to overcome those?
Well, we've been at this for nearly 30 years, so we have a pretty long experience in this international trade angle, niche, I guess you could call it. We often have to use a wholesaler because of the kind of the challenges of doing business with China. It's there's a lot of protocol involved, and oftentimes you have to use, I guess you call them Chinese nationals to help us with that. We have been over and tried to establish a more direct line with that, but that takes a lot of investment and time. But I think there's opportunity in China for more expansion. But right now, it makes more sense to go through the routes that we have. We have had members of the representatives from the Chinese government come over and visit our clam harvest beds. And we hosted them, and they went out and saw the harvest underway so they could see where these Suquamish seafoods enterprise clams come from, because primarily in Shanghai and also in outside some of the more major cities, they know our product. So they know the word Suquamish, they know our name. So when they came over, they're very familiar with our product because it is highly in demand. So I remember one time going into the market, and all these people gathered around me, and I sit there and go, "Have they ever seen anybody from the U.S. before?" And they go, "No, they think you have gooey duck."
you know, because they were all of the local suppliers were hungry for gooey duck, and they were out there at midnight. So there is a demand for it. We try to fill that. One of the things that challenges is sometimes the U.S. trade relationship, U.S.-China trade relationship can stop or slow down the market.
I would imagine.
Yeah, can that affect other people? You'll probably hear that export other food products, and we've had that happen, and we've worked with several administrations on trying to do that. But it is a challenge when, you know, you say the word Taiwan. Sometimes that can create a little bit of a challenge out there, but that's just part of our relationship with the U.S. and China. We're all subject to those political issues.
And, Chairman, I'd also like to ask you, what about just the cultural connection there and just working with the Chinese, working with some of these officials and business owners there in China? Have you had any interesting cultural exchanges that have either maybe helped you and maybe eased some of the business ventures you've had, or maybe have you had some setbacks? Can you talk about that?
When we've talked to each other, we have a lot in common in our cultural dependence on our people, and I think that they understand government-owned businesses. I think that's one thing that we had in common with China, because the government has a bigger role in business there. Because of their government structure. So they understood that concept. And also just a lot of curiosity about our culture, their culture, and reliance on our traditions to guide our future in business. And I found that was interesting. And they also remember, I remember I was there one time, and this one guy kept, asking about me, and I said, now, what's that guy keep asking? Why does that guy keep looking at me? And then I found out that he thought I was my older brother who'd been there like 10 years ago, and he said it promised him gooey duck, and he was wondering where it was. So they have long memories over there, want to engage in trade. It's just that you have to, like they said, some of the risk issues, some of the, relationship diplomacy is very important.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever hear comments from the Chinese like, you know what, we really like working with a tribe, and we see advantages working with the tribal nation as opposed to a non-native U.S. business?
I think there's some intrigue there. They, of course, they're looking, oftentimes you're working with entrepreneurs because the government basically handles the inspection and kind of the flow of goods. But oftentimes you're working with entrepreneurs there, and they're really looking for what they really want is a consistent supply. Oftentimes you'll get them saying, I need 10,000 pounds every month. It's like, oh, well, we'd love to give you 10,000 pounds every month, but we are at the risk of a wild harvest. So whether it's salmon or crab or gooey duck, it's hard to guarantee that. So that's something that we have to work on. And some of the enhancement we have might bring some more stability to our supply.
All right. Well, Chairman Forsman, really appreciate you joining us today from Washington State. Again, listeners, Chairman Leonard Forsman of the Suquamish Tribe. Chairman, thank you. Let's go ahead and bring in our next guest, Wayne Garnins-Williams, and he is with the International Intertribal Trade and Investment Organization. Wayne, thank you again for joining us, and I'm wondering if you're wishing you were here in Las Vegas right now. What do you think?
Yeah, normally I'm there, and just because of client matters, I can't be there, but I'm there in spirit. It's a great turnout, I'm sure, and it's always something fun. You make new friends, and you get to know people that are in a similarly situated business, so it's great to build colleagues there.
Well, tell us more about your work and your expertise with trade, and what do you look for with different countries and tribal businesses?
Sure. Our organization, IDIO, the International Intertribal Trade Investment Organization, we're a 501c3 educational charity incorporated out of Oklahoma. And we have representatives, not just in the United States, but we have representatives in Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Chinese Taipei, and soon to be Mexico and Peru. So it's that kind of reach that we're getting. And what we realize, our philosophy here, is we want to focus on that tribal, intertribal trade by helping at the grassroots level with respect to the mom-and-pop companies that are working on the kitchen table, and move them to the garage and then to the factory floor within their own tribal communities, and develop that. And to do that, it's a multifaceted process, because we realize for the real exercise of indigenous trade, not just regular trade that you'd find in the World Trade Organization that's happening now, but tribal trade with another tribe around the world. There are potentially rights that are there, inherent rights, that can be exercised potentially in cooperation with the federal government to help those mom-and-pop companies get from the factory floor, get from the kitchen table to the factory floor, and then out to the world tribal markets. So it's that kind of work that we're focused on. We see the big picture. We know we need to start with the infrastructure to assist federal governments in developing their policies for indigenous trade. Once they've got a solid indigenous trade policy, then they start using that policy to negotiate trade chapters that are indigenous trade chapters in international trade agreements. And then once those agreements are signed, there's opportunities for tribal corporations, for individual indigenous businesses to exercise that opportunity in that indigenous trade chapter to find new markets. So
All right. That's
what we're doing. It's really exciting. And what we've got, we've done this successfully with Canada and New Zealand. So our representatives there have really helped build the nation state policies, which have led to international trade agreements and now trade. And the United States, we're playing catch up here, but we're going to get there, and then we're going to really outperform.
Wayne, when you negotiate or you work with foreign countries, do you ever hear them comment and make statements like, well, we're a little bit worried about working with a tribal nation because they're sovereign, and what happens if we have a problem and we might have an issue with being able to, you know, how do we enforce something, or how do we, you know, if we need to sue a tribe for something? Do you ever hear comments like they're worried about how they would navigate tribal sovereignty through the court system or something like that?
Yeah, and that's the brilliance of cooperative federalism, in the sense that it's the exercise of tribal sovereignty in the U.S. is a cooperative mechanism with the United States federal government, especially when we're dealing with international trade. So how we develop those policies cooperatively to anticipate those problems so we can have a response that the tribes are comfortable with and the federal government's comfortable with, so that those things, those little bumps in the road that happen, we're ready for them.
And Wayne, what's the biggest question the questions you have from foreign countries that are looking to do business with tribes? What's their biggest question about tribal sovereignty? What don't they know? What do they want to know?
Yeah, with respect to tribal sovereignty, what they want to know is, the primary thing, of course, is what's your market? What do you got? What can we trade with? And when we look at trade from a traditional standpoint, we're not talking about European-based just widgets going across overseas. We're talking more about traditional indigenous trade. And when you look at the Maori in New Zealand, or the Inuk in the northern Canada, or elsewhere, there's a cultural aspect which is important too. So it's trade, but it's a cultural exchange, it's language preservation, it's giving back to the land. It's a whole ecosystem that has to be respected to conduct that trade, and a whole social strata that must be cooperatively explored together, so that each nation that's trading, each tribal nation, can benefit, not just profit-wise, but from a cultural standpoint and from an ecological standpoint, that they're more solid now together than they were apart.
And when you have tribes who come to you and they are interested in developing their businesses overseas, what's the first thing you tell them? What's the first step they need to take to make sure they do this right?
Well, the first thing is look at the market. Do the research. What, you know, your product, where do you want to go with it? And let's look at the relative clauses that you can pivot off of, whether or not they're international trade agreements. Like, for example, the Indigenous Peoples Economic Trade and Cooperation Agreement, called IPECTA, where the United States is an observer, has observer status, hopefully will soon be a member, and take advantage of that, where it's that IPECTA is an exclusive nation-to-nation, tribal-nation-to-tribal-nation trade arrangement supported by the nation-state of each of the members. And those members are, of course, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Chinese Taipei. So it's those kind of capacities where you look at what is out there with respect to your market and what have you got and what do you need as well, because it's a two-way street. You as a tribal nation or a tribal nation corporation or an individual that is a tribal member that's got a business, you're selling things, but you're also buying things because you have inputs as well. So you're exploring that and you're looking for opportunities overseas. You're also looking at price point. Does it make sense? Is it competitive? And that's where, for example, having those Indigenous-friendly policies that are collaboratively based, collaboratively built between the federal government and the tribes is so important, because it's not just the selling of widgets, as I said, it's helping communities get a leg up, build wealth, create jobs, keep those jobs within the communities, and keep that dollar circulating within the community, not going out to the big box stores, but that multiplier effect staying within the community. That's right, really key.
We're going to take another break. We come back, we're going to talk with Dr. Jim Collard, and we're also going to take a call. Stay with us.
Support by Archaeology Southwest. Did you know almost all major archaeological sites in the Southwest have been looted or vandalized? Looting and vandalism impact Indigenous people, past, present, and future. Every day, countless Native American cultural items are lost or damaged forever through looting and vandalism. Federal and tribal laws protect archaeological resources. More information about ending archaeological resource crime and how to submit a tip at savehistory.org and on social media at savehistory.
We're glad you're able to listen to today's show from the Reservation Economic Summit in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'm your host, Sean Spruce, and we've still got a lot to talk about. And if you would like to join this conversation, come on, give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. We've got a caller on the line right now, Chanupa, who is listening in Pine Ridge, South Dakota on Keeley Radio. Hello, Chanupa. I wish you were here in Las Vegas with us.
Hey, Wopiataka, Sean, I mean, this is a great thing to really do for our people. What you guys are talking about is the whole structure of what needs to be done in Indian country, okay? Now, I know this for a fact if it's testimonial that can work for our people. Our Tataka with different countries, there are people that were trying to invest in that many, many years ago. But because of the way certain, you know, iniquities go on, our people can't sell our meat outside. They only keep it in. And some of the Caucasian ranchers took our herds of buffalo. And so if we were to incorporate our buffalo, I hate using that term, but it's a way just to create a commerce exchange. And so our people can combat the diabetes, heart trouble, cancer, because our meat has medicine in it. And so because of that, we can't do anything with that matter because of the way people do things. Everybody like here today, what you are doing down there Nevada, okay? If people could demonstrate it in a Lakota's point of view, everything would be fine. That's all of it. All of it is medicine that will combat these problems. And that's what needs to be done. And we did contact with some here on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation from New Zealand. And so some of the Maori people come out here and seen it. And they took some of our dry meat back, which we call pemmican. In Lakota, they call it papa. So if we do that, that'll put an end to all of our hunger, poverty, and so forth. And I appreciate this topic because Katanka Talo, and thank you for having a good show tonight about that. And I'm I'm sorry yesterday we couldn't get on because the show didn't run yesterday. But, hey, we're on today. And thank you, Sean, for having that and taking my call. Hokahe from the Pioneers Union Reservation.
Hokahe, Chanupa, thank you for that call. Good comments there coming from Pine Ridge, South Dakota. And let's head a little bit south now from Pine Ridge all the way to Shawnee, Oklahoma, where we have our next guest waiting for us, Dr. Jim Collard. He is the Director of Planning and Economic Development for the Citizen Potawatomi Nation. And hello again, Jim. And let's talk a little bit more about what you folks have going on there, Citizen Potawatomi. And what countries are you folks currently engaged in trade with?
Okay, yeah, thank you for having me. Essentially, we operate at the dirt level, and that we're developing the Iron Horse Eco Industrial Park, following the principles of the circular economy, which has a focus on preserving and maximizing our natural resources. And we also have a fully functional operational foreign trade zone, which we can talk about. And, of course, we're anchored on a Class 1 rail line. So we're recruiting companies that operate within the sustainable energy space, but also are interested in talking to indigenous producers globally about thinking about us as an entry point into the North American markets. So it's a lot of cool stuff right now. We are have two Canadian, or our first two companies were Canadian. We're in discussions right now with two Australian Aboriginal companies and are also visiting with several groups in South America. So it's a good time to be here. It's a good time to be in this space. And really all we're doing, and it was kind of alluded to by the previous caller, this is not new. Essentially we are re-engaging in international indigenous trade, which existed multiple millennia, long before the creation of national boundaries. Very appreciative of all the work the IITIO, Wayne, is doing and his group and so on. It's exciting to be in this space right now.
Yeah, it really is, Jim. And just, you know, hearing from our guests today on the show and just here at the Reservation Economic Summit where I am, I'm just talking to so many people and just a lot of different interests in working overseas and a lot of food products. But like you mentioned, sustainable energy and some of these other ideas. And where do you see the biggest opportunities right now for tribes working in international markets?
Well, exporting and importing, of course, go hand in hand. They're mutually supportive of each other. In terms of export markets, Wayne very well addressed this very well. You need to start with a solid business model and see what the customers globally need. And I think that's where networks such as the IITIO come in handy, that acts as a clearinghouse that can match up what indigenous peoples are needing with and other indigenous peoples that can supply those products. The global supply chain is a big challenge, along with everyone else in international trade, working out the price points. But it really is product specific and region specific as well.
And when you work with other tribes and they come to you and they ask questions or they want to learn from your success and maybe some of your setbacks, what advice do you offer?
Well, to be patient, to be thorough, and to understand that the tribes operate within national frameworks as well. And sometimes people that operate at the national political level can be intimidated by Native Americans, indigenous people who are entering international trade. So that needs to be handled judiciously, but carefully in terms of how we present what we're doing in a way that helps the decision makers, particularly at the political level, understand that tribes produce huge economic multipliers for non-tribal citizens. The Citizen Potawatomi Nation, as an example, 2,400 employees, the majority of whom are not tribal members. So the economic benefits of the indigenous people and those production processes go well beyond the tribal communities. And that's a message that needs to be repeated over and over and over again.
And Jim, the industrial park, tell us more about that.
Sure. We have 700 acres. 400 of it is within a foreign trade zone. We have activated sites. Again, a Class 1 railroad with all the utilities in water, sewer. We have limitless, essentially, telecommunications capabilities, electrical capabilities, and so on. All the utilities that are necessary for successful operating business factories. It's a good location not only for assembly and manufacturing, but also distribution. Good way to enter the U.S. and North American markets. Obviously, we're players in the USMCA, United States-Canada-Mexico Agreement, formerly known as NAFTA. But as Wayne alluded to earlier, we're working with Peru, Colombia, and some of the South American countries, as well as New Zealand and Australia. And hopefully we'll expand beyond that. We have tribally owned CPN, System Power Nation, owns the Sovereign Pipe Technologies plant that started off as a Canadian company that located here, lost its funding during COVID. We, the CPN, took over those assets, and now we're producing high-density polyethylene pipe, which is an excellent mechanism for transporting everything from water and wastewater, petroleum products, telecommunication systems, but also is the best material available for transporting hydrogen long distance underground because it doesn't bond at a molecular level. So we are looking very seriously about entering the hydrogen energy space as well, not only from a standpoint of our HDPE pipe, but also as a location for hydrogen production. So really, there's nothing that the tribes cannot accomplish if they want to. And it's an interesting journey.
It really sounds like, Jim, and thank you again for coming on the show today and sharing some of the success and the highlights there from the Citizen Potawatomi Nation in Oklahoma. Continued success and good luck going forward.
Thank you. Yeah, you'll be hearing from us.
All right, looking forward to it. Let's go back to one of our in-person guests here. Deanna Mitrovic is back with us. Deanna, you took a little walk around the trade show, and now you're back. And, geez, it just seems like a lot of opportunities but some hurdles, too. And what are some of the key takeaways we really want our listeners to understand about this issue with tribes and Native entrepreneurs working in foreign markets and international trade?
Yeah, absolutely, Sean. So our agency partnered with the National Center to bring to you our Building Bridges to Global Markets sessions. So we are going to have a couple of panel sessions where you can learn more about the resources when it comes to the financials or any advices how you can get in touch with us. So we do invite your businesses to join the three panels that will focus on expert resources, expert finance, and connecting you with international buyers. And we serve actually very small businesses as well. So our majority of our clients are small. And we, our Undersecretary Lago kicked off the program just now during the fireside chat. She's going to also moderate the expert panel today at 2 o'clock. So please join us at Verona Room. We're going to be featuring also Native American businesses over there that utilize our services. And we are there like as your ally, as your friend that you can reach out to. And even if you start like really, really small, like I have many clients in rural Nevada because I oversee also rural Nevada, rural California, Southern California, rural Hawaii as well. We connect our clients also with some other resources. For example, one of mine is a woman-owned company, veteran-owned company, rural company, and she just got a grant from SBDC, like $20,000 to keep her manufacturing here in the U.S. So we are really well connected in our own, in our everyone's state so that we can help you overcome any challenge. And we also hear that the companies can be overwhelmed with international business regulations and licensing. So we can also help guide you by providing up-to-date information about every single country. And we do have on our website, trade.gov, you can access country commercial guides. We can also tell you a little bit more if you would like to read it. And then we can also connect you with our colleagues overseas, as I earlier mentioned, in the U.S. embassies and consulates abroad, who can guide you really if you have any concrete questions regarding to the product specific regulations or how you enter any specific country. And also another amazing joint opportunity is that our Undersecretary Lago just today announced also Expert Tech program put together along with the National Center. So we will be offering 6 3-hour sessions with individualized coaching over an 11-week period. That can accelerate company's strategic expert planning process and the marketing plan, how you can access those markets. As we say that usually like 80%, 85% of the purchasing power is abroad, and the companies that export simply mitigate the risk so that they don't rely on the national market as well. So we do encourage you to visit trade.gov to find an international trade specialist. Feel free to reach out to me. Sean, you have my contact, and we will be happy to help you. Okay.
Well, I guess my next question, Deanna, is when do you have time to sleep for all these projects you have going on?
I would also like to invite you to come to D.C. in June. So our Select USA program, and I know that some of your members and audience took part in the past. So that's the highest profile foreign direct investment event, and we, as American government, we facilitate that business investment by connecting thousands of investors, companies, and economic development organizations and industry experts to make these deals happen. So this year, June 23rd to 26th, National Harbor, Maryland, we invite you to join us over there.
All righty. Deanna, we've got a couple of minutes, about a minute and a half before we have to wrap up the show. Let's talk a little bit about COVID and its impact on the global supply chain, and what lessons did we learn with regard to that impact, and specifically with Native tribes and Native entrepreneurs doing business overseas?
Yeah, Sean, it is clear that COVID-19 pandemic had impact on people and communities around the world and, of course, Native businesses. But it also accelerated future growth in some areas like digitalization and supply chains. And it offers significant opportunities if you capitalize on those and innovation to drive sustainable economic development and business growth. We are much more connected now and we can work together in unity. And I believe also the motto of this conference is Strength in Unity at REST 2024. So we, as U.S. Commercial Service, we can help you with a website globalization review so that ensure that your website is user-friendly for international buyers and customers when they're searching for your products and services. I mentioned the Building Bridges to Global Markets program at REST, and also we will have officers from Export-Import Bank of the United States, the Small Business Administration, Department of Agriculture, over there to help you access with the securing financing and access to capital. It's a huge issue with all the businesses that are trying to do the international trade. And we also have a Small Business Administration Straight Trade Expansion Program, which provides financial awards to states and territories that assist small businesses with export development. So another resource for you.
Well, Deanna, thank you again. Keeping busy there, and enjoy the rest of the summit. And before you
Thank
head,
you,
are you staying through tomorrow?
Yeah, I think that our staff will be also here tomorrow if anybody would like to connect with them.
Wonderful, yeah. Wonderful.
Thank you.
Well, with that, we are out of time, so we're going to go ahead and wrap up this live broadcast from the trade show here at Caesars Palace, Las Vegas, Nevada, at the Reservation Economic Summit. So big thanks to our guests who joined us today, Deanna Mitrovic, Chris James, Chairman Leonard Forsman, Wayne Garnins-Williams, and Jim Collard, all of our guests. Wonderful conversation. And with that, we're going to be back again tomorrow here in Las Vegas, another day in sunny Las Vegas, and we'll hear from some of this year's Native 40 Under 40 awardees. And we hope you'll join us. And until then, I'm going to go ahead and sign off. Now I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Thank you.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Celebrate National Nutrition Month. Choose healthier food options for you and your loved ones. Sometimes it can be difficult to make good food choices, but there are many resources that can help. For more information, visit ihs.gov/diabetes or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.